You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello for the second week in a row from Paris-Nice, from me, Richard Moore, and I'm going to be joined by the usual motley crew a little bit later on. We've decided to split our coverage this week into two podcasts, a French one and an Italian one. In this one, the French one, we'll look back at Paris-Nice, and later in the week, we'll review Tirreno-Adriatico and preview Milan-San Remo. There is stage five of Paris-Nice getting underway. So I'll be joined by Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney a little bit later on, but I can't quite review Paris-Nice yet because, as you can hear, it's still going on. And I'm at the start of stage five in Vienne. I was by the banks of the Loire for last week's podcast, and today I'm standing near the banks of the Rhône as it meanders through Vienne, ahead of what should be another sprinter stage with a headwind all day, apparently, today. Yesterday afternoon, we finished at Chirouble in Beaujolais country after a tough up-and-down stage with a 7-kilometre climb at the end. It was a stage that had Primoz Roglic written all over it. And lo and behold, it was Rog who got his Jumbo-Visma team to take control at the front. Tony Martin and Jos van Emden, then George Bennett, and finally Stephen Kruijswijk all did a lot of work before a very sharp-looking Rog took off to win by 12 seconds. Ahead of the defending champion, Max Schachmann of Bora Hansgrohe. I'd spoken to Schachmann at the start of the stage about his team's relatively poor start to the season. We've spoken a bit about them being one of the big five or big four teams, and they've had a poor start, a sluggish start to the season. Schachmann bristled a little bit at that, but he did point out that the absence of Peter Sagan, who caught COVID on a training camp at Gran Canaria, had really had a big impact.
Obviously we hadn't have our best start, but I think the season is young. The really big main races are coming up. We got some bad luck also with Peter. That can happen in those times, and yeah, I think it's nothing is lost. The season ends in next October.
And what about for you this year? I mean, you're defending champion here, obviously, but what are your big goals this year?
Yeah, it's obvious that this is it's important for me, but I hadn't had the best preparation. It's my first race. I always miss a bit of the race rhythm in my legs. So I take this race to really get into shape. And I'm going to race San Remo, Basque Country and the Ardennes Classics. And yeah, I think all those races are like pretty important for me.
We still don't really know what kind of rider you're going to become, I guess. You can obviously win stage races and also go well and race like the Ardennes Classics. Do you have a preference at the moment?
No, not really. I think in the end it's not bad that I can do a lot of things. Maybe I will keep that my entire career. Maybe I will focus on some specialities in the future, but not sure about it yet.
And in terms of Grand Tours, will you go back to the Tour de France this year?
I'm not sure, to be honest. We're going to make that decision in beginning of May, after my first block of racing. I think everything is a bit uncertain, also concerning the Olympic Games. So we have to wait a bit. IOC says it's pretty safe. Japanese society says something different. I don't know.
Are the Olympics quite a big focus for you this year?
Yeah, I think the races suit me pretty well. The time trial as well as the road race. And it's every... Just you get the opportunity just every 4 years, so I'm focusing it.
Well, a few hours later on, Schachmann's second at Chirouble offered some encouragement, but there was an inevitability about Rog's performance on the first climbing stage and hilltop finish. And in Chirouble, at the summit of the climb, I spoke to his teammate, the New Zealand road race champion George Bennett. Bennett had suffered a crash on stage one in which he seemed to bash his head quite badly, and there were fears of concussion from the TV pictures at least. But after following the concussion protocol, which involved answering four questions, he was allowed to carry on. This issue came up on stage four, however, to Shiroub when Teo Gegenhart crashed and was forced to quit. He later tweeted, "Landed on my head today. Thank you, Ineos Grenadiers and the medical team for putting my long-term welfare first when it was clear I wasn't 100%. Little rest, no screen time, and hopefully back soon." So that was Teo Gegenhart, but let's hear what George Bennett had to say at the end of stage four.
Oh, mate, I'm creeping a bit, but, man, pretty awesome that Roglic was able to finish it off, you know? We took the race on, and, man, Tony and Jos just made me suffer, and then, yeah, I'm glad it was worth it, you know?
Are you feeling the after effects from your crash? Are you okay after that?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm definitely hurting a bit, more than I thought I was, but, I mean, you know, you hit the ground at full speed, it's not going to make you go faster, you know?
Was it just your head, or were there other injuries?
Yeah, I mean, normal stuff, you know, nothing major. Nothing that's going to be a problem long term. Fortunately, my head's fine, and that's the main thing that I'm, you know, that obviously other people were worried about, but that was fine, no memory loss, nothing like that. So all the other stuff, just aches and bumps and things like that, but I think just in general, I'm just not riding very well at the moment. It's just trying to preserve the form for the Giro, and it makes it hard to be really flying now, you know. It's quite a niggly time. I mean, if you're in the Tour, you can already be really good now, take a break and be good again. But in the Giro, if you're really good now, I think it's a long way to be good until the end of May. So,
is it hard coming back? I know you were in New Zealand for the winter, just adjusting back to European life again.
Yeah, that's hard as well, you know. But I mean, I'm pretty at home here. But yeah, I mean, it's a bit challenging this year with the quarantine and stuff. You know, my girlfriend partner's actually stuck in New Zealand for a bit, and so she might not be over until end of Giro. So, you know, there's all sorts of new challenges with the pandemic and borders and things like that. So, you know, you just have to adjust and definitely a bit of a shock coming back here and racing in the cold and all that stuff, but you know, it's also great to be here, and I'm really excited to be racing again, and I'm sure I'll get a lot more enjoyment out of it when I start you know, with the race and the legs and all that stuff. So yeah, standard stuff.
Roberts, you didn't see him, but he just looks the same. I mean, he's Mr. Consistent, isn't he?
Oh mate, he's insane. I was with him in Tenerife, and yeah, I was the worst guy on that camp, and I was pretty scary watching those boys train and seeing what he was doing up the hills. I've never seen him so good, actually, if I'm honest. I think that was the best he's ever been. So I'm glad he showed the world today as well that, it's not just training form, it translates. And, man, he's just such a special rider, and I'm happy he's on my team, you know?
Well, Roglic better than ever. That sounded ominous. And Roglic's demeanour here has been quite striking too. He's seemed very relaxed and cracking jokes, quite different to the Rog that we saw at the Tour de France last year in particular. Before we skip ahead to the finish of the race and catch up with Lionel and Daniel, I spoke to another rider at the finish of Stage 4. Oliver Nasson, the AG2R Classics man, had managed a very curious feat. In each of the first three stages, he was 85th. And stage three, let's not forget, was a time trial, so a remarkable achievement. On stage four, Nasson was in the break before eventually crossing the line in 43rd. I wondered if he was disappointed that his run of 85th places had come to an end.
You managed to finish 85th again today on the stage, three stages in a row, 85th.
I tried, but the bunch was split too much already. I couldn't wait the guys. So yeah.
Is it some kind of bet or something?
Somebody sent me a message this morning that I was three times 85th, so must have found my spot here in Paris.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker. Very grateful to them for their support. If you run a small business, you'd like to know what iWalker can do for you, go to iwalker.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Well, I'm back from Pyrenees, and I've been joined by Daniel Freib and Lionel Burney. Hello, Daniel.
Hello.
Hello, Lionel.
Hello.
Sorry, we're all misaligned because obviously I've been on the road, and now we're hooked up remotely. How are you, chaps? I mean, since I recorded that package that we heard at the start there, obviously, well, a significant twist to the tale of Paris-Nice. I had to come home a little bit early and I watched the rest of the race on my television, as I know you guys did, and Daniel, you were working for ITV on the race as well, so you paid very close attention. As I said in that first part, we're doing two podcasts this week. In this one, we're going to focus on Paris-Nice and also discuss the Richard Freeman case and the latest in that. And in the episode coming later in the week, we will be turning our attention to Tirreno Adriatico and looking ahead to Milan-San Remo. But Lionel and Daniel, it was quite a... I think we thought, and I thought when I left Paris-Nice, that it was done and dusted. You know, Rog looked impenetrable. We heard... impervious. We heard from George Bennett there say that he's in better form than he's ever been. That's perhaps not in question even after what happened on the last day. But it was quite a twist, wasn't it, Daniel?
Yes, it was, which I think we'll discuss in more detail, won't we, later. Wasn't quite the same calibre of race as last year. I thought the 2020 edition of Paris-Nice was an absolute crackerjack edition from day one, really, which wasn't the case this time, but it was a hell of a coup de grace at the end, wasn't there?
It was, and a much-needed win for Bora Hansgrohe, I think. But Lionel, I think you're going to run us through exactly what happened at Paris-Nice by way of a news roundup this week.
Yeah, I will. I'll do a Paris-Nice roundup, picking up where we left off in last week's podcast, which was with Stefan Bissiger of EF Education Nippo in the yellow jersey. And, well, Primoz Roglic, we thought, I certainly thought, given the strength of the field, Roglic was looking like he would inherit the yellow jersey on the following day's summit finish, uphill finish, and that is indeed what happened. He won the first of his three stages on stage four. That was also the day that Theo Gegenhardt crashed out, Richard, as you mentioned in your little summary from Paris-Nice. He hit the ground, banged his head and pulled out of the race. And just a little side note on that, I thought the way he dealt with that was actually pretty impressive. It sort of took the stigma out of quitting a race because of a concern over a collision to the head, and I think that's something that all of the teams can learn from, really. Destigmatizing pulling out of races because of potential worries over head injuries. Anyway, Roglic did the first of two consecutive doubles, Paris-Nice Tirreno Adriatico doubles, didn't he? Because he won the Paris-Nice stage, and meanwhile, over at Tirreno Adriatico, Wout van Aert won. And the following day, De Koninck Quickstep did the same thing. Sam Bennett won his second stage of the race, and Julian Alaphilippe won over in Italy. We'll obviously talk much more about Tirreno Adriatico in the second of this week's podcast. Roglic then carried on doing what Roglic does, which is ruthlessly winning stages. He won stage six and then stage seven. And we may well discuss the rights and wrongs of the manner in which he won that stage, because he pipped Gino Maeder of Bahrain victorious, Bahrain not victorious on this occasion, pipped him on the line. Maeder looked like he was going to hang on for what would have been a pretty spectacular win for the young man. But Roglic showed absolutely no mercy whatsoever, hunting that time bonus just to make doubly certain of the yellow jersey. And of course, that controversy was put into a completely different complexion the next day, the final stage of the race. Should mention that both of those last two stages over the weekend were altered. Sunday stage in particular was changed because they weren't allowed to go down into Nice. The mayor of Nice basically wanted to keep the Promenade des Anglais and the seafront open to people in Nice who were under quite a strict lockdown, so the race wasn't allowed to go down into the town. And, well, Roglic came to grief twice on the same descent, tore holes in both sides of his shorts, very, very uncomfortable looking wounds on, particularly on his left side. Also dislocated his shoulder, but presumably popped that back in and carried on chasing. After the second crash,
you learn anything from that? You learn anything from that, Lionel?
I just find that absolutely unfathomable, carrying on with any kind of injury to the collarbone or shoulder.
I mean, by the same token, it's unfathomable that you're here today. You know, with your soldiering on through this podcast.
The Roglic of the podcast, as we've always called you.
A mere 6 weeks after your crash.
It's only 2 weeks, actually, everyone. Anyway, Max Schachmann and Bora Hansgrohe. I think the peloton really kind of allowed Roglic to get back in the first time, but second time, not so fortunate, Roglic. He got very close to regaining contact, but didn't quite make it. And the race was really on at the front. And Bora Hansgrohe and Astana both had plenty of incentive to push on. And Magnus Cort of EF Education Nippo won the sprint finish. A really impressive stage victory for Cort. And Max Schachmann won Paris-Nice for the second year in a row. And as you say, Daniel, perhaps not the barnstorming race that we saw last year, but the drama on the last 2 days, I thought, really capped off Paris-Nice this year.
And what do we make, chaps, of, as some have pointed out, that's three stage races in France in a row where Roglic has come unstuck at the last moments. You know, obviously the Dauphiné last year, the Tour de France, famously, and now Paris-Nice. He again won a lot of plaudits and earned some praise for his reaction to his latest misfortune. You know, he just kept on working, kept on trying, persevered until the very end, and once again showed great humility and grace at the finish and congratulating a pretty sheepish Schachmann. I thought Schachmann was kind of a sort of reluctant winner in a way. He didn't particularly enjoy winning in those circumstances. Not quite the same as last year for him.
He was sheepish. No real need, I don't think, to be sheepish. I mean, he explained the circumstances afterwards that he'd had a puncture earlier in the day and chased hard to get back on. No one had waited then. I mean, instinctively, when you first see this, the most sacred of all these arcane rules of etiquette in cycling is that you never attack the yellow jersey, isn't it? Whether it's Paris-Nice or the Tour de France. But then, if you take into account that it was the second incident after the first one, the peloton did wait for Roglic. Also, the last stage of Paris-Nice was not set up to be a procession. It was set up to be a racing day. It was shorter than advertised. It was only 92 kilometers instead of 110. So it was really eyeballs out from kilometer zero. There was a break down the road. Lots of teams in the peloton hadn't got anything thus far out of Paris-Nice. We're going for the stage win. So it's kind of very difficult to freeze that, moment in time and to take and to weigh up, all the different interests and, the implications of one scenario or another scenario. And I certainly don't blame Schachmann or Bora for carrying on. I did wonder, we heard from a few of the protagonists yesterday. I did wonder if there was complete consensus in the peloton. There was a moment where Luis Leon Sanchez seemed to be sort of remonstrating with the Bora guys or even members of his own team actually at one point. And he's a rider of the older generation, and maybe this is something that wouldn't have happened in the 90s, for example, in the noughties, for example. Perhaps things have changed slightly on that score, but then racing's changed. It's more intense. We don't have as many sort of processions or formalities. There used to be huge tracks of the Tour de France where nothing really happened, whereas increasingly we're seeing, it's racing. The racing's turned on from kilometre zero and it doesn't stop until they cross the line.
Yeah, I think, Daniel, the fact that Roglic had crashed twice is significant. The first time he got back in, the second time nearly made it but didn't quite. I mean, a short explosive stage, as you say. At the end of the day, a stage race or any bike race is a test of man and machine. And being able to go around the corners and go down the descents without falling is a prerequisite, isn't it? I'm not saying that that means that there should be a real gloves-off mentality and that any time anyone falls or has a mechanical problem, it should be, right, off we go, let's really put them out the back and take advantage. But I don't think that was the scenario here, was it? Again, we're talking about midway through a very short stage, probably only an hour and 10 of racing time left, and it was a it was a situation where the race is on.
But,
and
the difficulty,
that's kind of it.
The difficulty, Lionel, you sort of summed it up there when you said that, you know, you don't think that it was, okay, straight to the front, let's attack him because he's punctured and because he's crashed going down a hill. But, you know, at what point is it okay, and to what extent is it okay to, you know, surge to the front and take advantage? If we're going to say, and I agree with you in principle, but if we're going to say that, for example, whether it be tyre durability or bike handling, they're all part of the race. You know, we talk about teams, we sort of, you know, we praise and celebrate teams who are well organised and, you know, plough more resources than other teams into R&D and so forth. So, you know, if that's all part of racing, punctures, crashes and whatever, why shouldn't another team, another rider take full advantage when one of those things falls or malfunctions?
Also, let's not... situational specific, isn't it? But let's not forget that... More increasingly, you've said that the racing's changed, Daniel, and one aspect in which it's changed has been on the descents, and especially on a short stage like that. Every metre of road counts. And, you know, when Nibali's, you could argue that Nibali put Kruijswijk under the sort of pressure that forced him to make a mistake at the Giro in 2016 and crashed. Nobody suggested that Nibali should have waited for Kruijswijk, who was in the pink jersey. One of the difficulties in this one, perhaps, is that we didn't actually see what happened, but it's feasible that Bora Hansgrohe and Astana, who later came to the front, were putting the pressure on, and that might have contributed to Roglic making a mistake. We don't know.
I think where the line is, I mean, it's so subjective, Daniel, and it depends on circumstances, it depends on a mood in the peloton, it depends on, you know, hundreds of different factors, you know, what the GC standings look like and who's where, and... how far there is to go, and all of these little things, and there's split seconds to make these decisions as well. And I suppose when it comes down to it, there's nothing to say that if Bora Hansgrohe or Astana had got over the radio the news that Roglic is down again, and they'd gone to the front and had drilled it as a result to basically have the race to share amongst themselves, or, you know, jump up a few places overall. They are entitled to do that. I mean, it's an unwritten rule, right? They are entitled to do that as long as they are aware that there may well be comeback consequences for that at future races. There might be a scenario where, I don't know, Astana are leading a race and Jumbo-Visma decide that they're going to turn the screw and stitch them up in a future event. I mean, these are this kind of, it's a bit of a cliche, but the sense that the peloton is a society on wheels, you know, it will sort of mete out its own sporting justice on the road in the future. And what I think we learned from Jumbo-Visma's reaction afterwards, which in the circumstances was extremely magnanimous. I mean, they took it well. And Grisha Neerman, well, let's hear from Grisha Neerman, the Jumbo-Visma sports director. His reaction straight after the stage, I think, says it all.
Yeah, we didn't manage it well today. Eh? It was a really bad day for us. We almost crashed in the first descent here, and he got back quite fast. That wasn't the problem, but then he crashed again in the second descent, same descent. That time I think he dropped his chain. It took some time to get his chain back on, and he just got on the bike with the last riders of the peloton. But yeah, nobody saw it. The commissars didn't see it, so they made a barrage for him. And that's a real pity. He made it till 20 meters behind the group, but then the elastic snapped and it was over. Yeah, I think the first time the peloton waited, it was fair play, and the second one they didn't. But that's life, that's cycling, and I think also, yeah, you can't blame anyone. Also, maybe not everybody saw him crashing, whatever, and that is cycling. Maybe we would have done the same if we would be in the second and the third position. So it's we can blame ourselves today that we must crash twice and that we weren't able to get him back to the peloton, and all the other circumstances they were not in our favor, but we go on.
So that was Grisha Neerman, the sports director at Jumbo-Visma, holding his hands up as he did on social media as well, saying they made mistakes. What mistakes did they make? I mean, Roglic was obviously isolated, alone, didn't have the team support that he might have liked. They had a strong team there, Jumbo-Visma, but they lost Tony Martin, who would have been a significant ally, I suspect. Stephen Kruijswijk was there, George Bennett was there for a while, And it seemed as if they made one mistake in particular, which was that Bennett was helping for a while. Kruijswijk was a good help. And then I think they thought they'd done the job. I think they thought, Kruijswijk thought, that he got Roglic close enough to the back of the bunch for Roglic to make one big effort and get back on. And he swung off, he obviously completely spent, and Roglic couldn't get back on, and that was it. And they kind of, I don't know if they panicked, and if they, you know, we see this, don't we? We saw this with Pino and Francis De Jure, Groupama Francis De Jure, at the Tour de France last year in the crosswind stage, where they almost closed the gap, but perhaps panicked trying to close it too quickly. Very, very difficult to do this. And with Bora Hansgrohe and Astana drilling it at the front, it was sort of them against Roglic on his own, and the gap just grew and grew all the way to the finish. But I mean, should the inquest at Jumbo-Visma be what happened to the team?
Oh, I think absolutely. It's obviously not their biggest priority this year. I mean, Rich, you mentioned the races that Rog has lost on the last day in the last year. I mean, he's lost a Paris-Nice, a Dauphiné, and a Tour de France now, essentially. And, you know, for some riders, I was thinking earlier that, I mean, that's largely Bradley Wiggins' palmarès in stage races. I mean, I know he won a couple of Dauphinés, didn't he? But you know, that's a lot to lose, and it's only in the context of what else Rog has done over the past few seasons that it seems to pale. But I think they will be slightly concerned, not about, you know, I was wondering yesterday about sort of mental scar tissue in Roglic himself, and a sort of, you know, whether a choke reflex might have been instilled. Now, I don't think that's the case. I don't think anyone is saying that. With, you know, knowing Roglic as we do now, knowing his mentality, but you know, you would imagine that if they are put in that in a similar situation again, that there will be more edginess, and that edginess can lead to other mistakes. The other thing I wonder is whether this morning some of the sort of Denzians of 20, 30 years ago, guys who were in the peloton then or director sportives then, were watching that yesterday and could not quite believe that Jumbo-Visma and Grisha Neerman and the other DSs, I don't know who the other DS was, but didn't have it in them, or it wasn't possible to form some kind of alliance using possibly slightly, well, not strictly legal means, but you know, things we know have gone on in the past, struck, you know, agreements, whether money's changing hands or favors are changing hands. But part of me does think that a scenario like we saw yesterday would not have happened 20 or 30 years ago. You know, a team, the most powerful team, or certainly one of the most powerful teams in the world, with a rider who also, and we'll talk about sympathies and affinities towards Roglic, but Roglic, I mean, it's my understanding, and I think you guys would agree with me, he's well liked in the peloton. You know, he's not seen as a tyrant who, you know, people are absolutely desperate to get one over on. I can't quite believe that the best that he could find yesterday, when he'd used up his team, was Nasser Bouhanni and Danny van Poppel for a few kilometers. Am I being too sort of conspiratorial and criminal minded?
I mean, no, I think you're right. I think, but one of the problems there was that the bodies were strewn everywhere, weren't they? And he was never in that big a group, so there were perhaps never enough.
But there were a lot of guys. In the peloton
who could have dropped back. But that would have been a bit more. Flagrant, wouldn't it?
Fake to mechanical, or
yeah, I mean,
my brake pads are rubbing. Off I go. Primoz, where are you?
Extraordinary.
The interesting thing about Roglic as well is that he embodies these two completely opposing characteristics of being both infallible and very fallible. You know, we'd been talking about sort of Rog the robot, the you know, gobbling up three stages and just kind of winning in this machine-like fashion. And then, you know, with these three races in particular, you see a completely different Roglic, where he's obviously vulnerable and fallible, and
he's a malfunctioning robot. Robot, you know, looks absolutely unbeatable until the moment that his eye kind of pops out on a spring and one arm falls out of its socket.
And well, he just puts it back in, doesn't he?
The digital display on the front goes wrong. He starts talking gibberish.
Lionel, what do you think about, particularly, I know some of the stories that you've, that Sean Kelly, for example, has told you. You know exactly what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, alliances, both paid and unpaid, are a part of the sport's history. I mean, I must admit, I don't really know whether all of that has died out now. I mean, it's not something that you can never really get anywhere talking to people about. It doesn't feel like it's a hot topic, but I do get what you mean. But I mean, are you really suggesting that, you know, Jumbo-Visma should have got on the radio to, I don't know, Cofidis and Movistar and AG2R?
Well, Cofidis were at the front working pretty hard for Christophe Laporte, but some were suspicious of that as well.
I remember, and I've actually written about this, and I actually named the rider, but I'm not going to name him here. People might have read the piece that I wrote a few years ago, but Davide Rebellin was in the process of losing a Paris-Nice a few years ago, and he did lose it, and he found himself isolated, I think, on the last stage. I think Contador won in the end. Anyway, a few days later, I was at a hotel, and there was a former luminary of Italian cycling was there with the Liquigas team, and they were discussing the Paris-Nice. And this individual said, I don't know what Rebellin was doing. At that point, you just get your checkbook out. And that kind of...
No one uses checks well, anymore, Daniel. It's like contactless.
You'd have to use PayPal or something, wouldn't you? But I don't know. I honestly don't know if it's completely died out.
So what you're suggesting is that riders from other teams could have dropped back and given Roglic a bit of help getting back into the peloton with a little contactless device in their jersey pocket.
I'm just looking for my contactless device here in my drawer to see if it would fit in a pocket.
I mean, another slightly more serious point I was going to make was that, you know, there was a lot of talk about whether Gino Maeder should have been Roglified the day before. And, you know, the process of Roglification dictates that everything basically standing in his way, you know, in the last kilometre of an uphill finish has to be Roglified, and that's what happened. But this was, you know, people, I think rightly, and I think it's a reasonable point, suggested that maybe if that hadn't happened, then Bahrain Inauspicious, as I think what they're now called after that stage, could have helped him on the last day. But, you know, it's also true that there are a lot of ways to secure, well, to create alliances, loyalties. You know, I mentioned the fact that Roglic is I think is pretty well liked. That's one way. You know, the issue of the Saturday stage and Maeder, whether Maeder, well, he should have let him win, I'm not sure. I mean, I tried to think back to other good examples of this in the past. I remember the one that came to my mind immediately was Laurent Jalabert in the 1995 Vuelta, won on Sierra Nevada. It was the Queen's stage, and a German rider, Bert Dietz, had been off the front, but he'd been off the front for 140 kilometers solo, and Jalabert caught him on the line and let him win. But even that, I went back today and read some of the Spanish coverage at the time, and Jalabert said afterwards he'd done that because Once had been accused in the days leading up to that stage of being tyrant, of being despotic, of dominating the race. So, you know, he felt under pressure not to do that again, not to commit the crime that the whole team was being accused of. So the Maeder one was a tough one as well. Like I say, I mean, I kind of make a joke about it that, you know, everything we're in cycling at the moment, we're in the middle of a period of a program of mass roglification, and everything.
Well,
everything in Jumbo's Visma's path has to be roglified.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. That's the kind of the duality of Roglic, isn't it? We saw it at Paris-Nice, and especially now with these experiences had in these three races and in the future, there's no reason at all for Roglic not to take whatever's in front of him. You know, he's not. I also wonder how it would have looked. I mean, would that have been a glorious way for Maeder to win, being allowed the win like that? As you say, Daniel, it wasn't a sort of 100 plus kilometer solo breakaway or anything like that. It was a, you know, a good effort by the guy, but his reaction on social media was pretty much along these lines that it was up to him to win, not up to Roglic to let him win.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we spent the whole of last year's the debrief from the Tour de France basically saying, what if Roglic had just been a bit more ruthless and if they'd turned the screw a bit more Jumbo-Visma when they were so on top in the Tour de France, you know, some extra seconds here, there and everywhere might well have kept Tadej Pogacar at, you know, out of reach for the La Planche des Belles-Filles final time trial. And I think, I do think, again, you know, the riders do have, especially in those circumstances, do have a sort of a duty to try to win the event. I mean, that is the point. I mean, Roglic was, you know, sprinting for the time bonus seconds, of course, and the stage win. I do wonder if it had been a more established rider, whether it would have been slightly humiliating. You know, if it had been, just thinking of Bahrain Victorious, I know he's not, wasn't at Paris-Nice, but Mikel Landa, for example, you know, being sort of overtaken 20 metres from the line by Roglic might have been pretty embarrassing for Landa. Roglic might have thought differently in those circumstances. He might not have done. But I don't think you can criticise Primoz Roglic for winning the race, and I think doubly so given what happened to him on the following day. I mean, you know,
you can also say it's humiliating, embarrassing to win in those circumstances if you're allowed to win. You know, remember the famous Armstrong Pantani case at Mont Ventoux when Armstrong let Pantani win and Pantani and that backfired completely, you know. So I don't think in that situation you know, Roglic can really win from a kind of court of public opinion point of view. He's got to do what he's paid to do, which is win the race.
And what if it had come down to 4 or 5 seconds on Sunday, exactly, if Roglic hadn't been quite so badly injured or had managed to get himself, you know, in touching distance of the leaders, and it had been decided by a handful of seconds, and the difference was that he hadn't sprinted for the time bonus the previous day. I mean, that would be something to reproach him for. I think you just have to, you know, I mean, Daniel, you're a golfer. You have to play the hole as it's in front of you. You can't sort of imagine, you know, what might happen 2 or 3 holes further down the course. And I think Roglic did the right thing. You know, he had the chance to win the stage and he won it. If Gino Maeda wanted to win, he should have pedalled harder in the last 500 metres. That is very flippant. But that's bike racing, folks.
Well, and just finally, you know, if people are approaching Roglic for being, you know, cold and heartless and so on, you know, we've already seen that that's not the case, because he's already allowed a plucky young upstart to, you know, to take victory on the penultimate day of a major race. And yeah, so he's got form on that score. I actually stole that joke. That was a French account on Twitter made that on Saturday. I think it was very good. Just finally, chaps, in case we are about to move on from Rog, this was something I was just looking at over the week or over the weekend, and I put this on Twitter as well, but I think we should take a moment to just take stock of how extraordinary Roglic's record is in stage races. The last time he didn't wear the leader's jersey in a stage race was that would have been extraordinary, and the 2018 Tour de France. He has worn the leader's jersey in all 12 stage races he's done since then. 12 in a row. I went back and looked today. Not even Eddie Merckx did that. No one has ever done that in history, as far as I can tell. I went back to Fausto Coppi. Back then, they didn't really race quite as many stage races, and it's quite difficult. The record keeping isn't really up to scratch. It's very difficult to establish. But certainly, Merckx had runs of a year, just over a year, but never anything like what Roglic is currently accomplishing.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport, our long-time supporters. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25. And if you have a question for James Morton at Science in Sport, please email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Almost a year ago, I was due to do a couple of shows in America with Ian Boswell in Washington, D.C. and New York. They had to be postponed, obviously, but a year on, and it's not really clear when we're going to be able to reschedule those. Some of you got refunds at the time. Some of you requested that we keep the money and they could renew their tickets when the shows were rescheduled. With such uncertainty still, we're going to refund everybody. So I think everybody paid through PayPal. We'll arrange for refunds for for those shows. One or two of you have got in touch, so.
Napalm, it's like he thinks he's Robbie Williams trying to crack America.
Cracking America on his own, solo career.
Well, yeah. It wasn't quite solo. I had Ian Boswell as my support act. Yeah. So we will reschedule these. I mean, one or two people said that they hope we can all go and do a few events in America. So watch this space. When we can travel again, anything's possible. Any other odds and sods from Paris-Nice, Lionel?
Well, I was just going to run through a few who had a good week, who had a bad week. I mean, the obvious good weeks for Sam Bennett, a couple of stage wins, and for EF Education Nippo, two stage wins. You know, they were kind of outstanding. But also Astana, who had a pretty good week with the other two places on the podium behind Max Schachmann, Alexander Vlasov in second place and Jon Izagirre in third. Very visible all week. Vlasov had a mechanical problem at one point on one of the uphill stages, but got himself back into things. And if things had turned out slightly differently over that final weekend, I mean, obviously you didn't know that Roglic was going to have such a shocker on Sunday, but you know, perhaps they might have pushed things a bit harder if they'd known that the win was going to be up for grabs. But Max Schachmann for Bora Hansgrohe, two wins in a row at Paris-Nice, only another five to go to equal Sean Kelly's record of seven Paris-Nice wins in a row. Not such a great week for Brandon McNulty of UAE Team Emirates, who crashed out on stage six when he was very well placed overall. And also Ineos Grenadiers had a pretty disappointing week. I mean, they lost Richie Port, twice former winner of Paris-Nice, of course. He crashed out on stage one, and then Theo Gegenhardt crashed out on stage four. So really their GC hopes went up in smoke there. And one question, Richard, we heard from Matteo Jorgensen, the young American rider with the Movistar team, in the podcast, was it last week or a couple of weeks ago?
And 2 weeks ago.
He was flying, wasn't he? And then had a slightly disappointing day on Saturday and then clawed himself back up to eighth place overall. So a pretty good week's work for a 21-year-old American there.
I think he had a very hard day on Saturday and dropped down a few places because he was as high as fifth overall. And then moved back up to eighth overall in the end, didn't he? But his first experience leading Movistar, he seemed to appreciate the support he had from that team. We're very blasé, aren't we? He's 21. And to lead the team and finish eighth overall is quite a promising result. He's a good all-rounder, I think. And he'll have gained from that and a very promising result.
Couple of footnotes, chaps, just on the French team's intriguing performances there. Groupama FDJ had a bad week. Unfortunately, David Gourdou crashed in the same crash as Theo Gegenhardt, and that seemed to knock the stuffing out of him a bit, and then he crashed again and abandoned yesterday. Cofidis, I don't know what you made of Cofidis. Sometimes their tactics were slightly baffling. It was tricky because there were a couple of routes there that seemed to favour climbers and actually favoured sprinters and almost vice versa. So they had Guillaume Martin and Christophe Laporte in the same group on a couple of days. And it wasn't exactly poetry in motion between those two. But Laporte's a good outside bet, I think, for Milan-San Remo, very much an outside bet. And then the other French team whose performance kind of intrigued me, AG2R Citroën have made a big investment this year in Greg Van Avermaet and Bob Jungels. Jungels had a very bad week. I spoke to him before the race and he seemed quite confident of how he was riding in his form, and he had a very bad week. And Van Avermaet, I don't know. I guess they've paid him a decent, they will be paying him a very decent salary. And, you know, you just worry slightly with what's happening at Tirreno and the not just emergence, but the sort of domination of Alaphilippe and Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel. Van Avermaet's starting to look a little bit like, you know, part of a fading generation. Hope that's not the case for him. But, chaps, at the same time, much brighter notes for AG2R. They've had some of their young riders have had a really cracking start to the season. Jean Poussin, who wasn't at Paris-Nice, but Paris Peintre was very good at Paris-Nice, and Ben O'Connor is riding well also. So interesting there. Their results are not necessarily coming from the places you would expect at the moment.
very, very final footnotes then for mention for Lucas Hamilton, young Australian rider with Team Bike Exchange, their best rider overall in fourth. And Tish Benoot, who seems to really love Paris-Nice, was on the podium, I think, last year, and fifth place again for him for Team DSM.
Well, chaps, the other big bit of news in the last week doesn't really concern the racing that's going on at the moment, but the shadows from it are cast right up to the present day, certainly. And the verdict came finally in the Richard Freeman Tribunal, his hearing by the General Medical Council in the UK. There were various charges against him, and he had already admitted most of them. The key one from a sporting point of view was his explanation about the testosterone that was delivered to the velodrome in Manchester in 2011. It really caught himself up in a web of lies around that, Dr. Freeman, who was the doctor for British Cycling and Team Sky. And his account to the tribunal was that it had been ordered for Shane Sutton to treat his erectile dysfunction. Shane Sutton denied that, rejected that, and made quite a theatrical appearance at the tribunal. From what I understand, Richard Freeman and his team were confident that he would not be found guilty of having ordered the testosterone for an athlete, to dope an athlete, because testosterone, we've talked a lot about grey areas in the past with regard to TUEs and triamcinolone and so on. You know, testosterone does not fall into any grey area. Testosterone is cheating if it's for an athlete. And so in the end, the tribunal, surprisingly to some people, decided that Freeman had ordered this testogel to be administered to an athlete. This really kind of ramps up the forthcoming hearing by UK Anti-Doping, who have now charged Richard Freeman. But to get a kind of understanding of what happened at the tribunal, what it was like, and where it leaves us, I spoke to Sean Ingle of The Guardian. Now, Sean, I think, has spent more time at the tribunal following events there than any other journalist. Spent a lot of time there, but Sean has been there throughout and tweeting a lot from it and writing on it for The Guardian, his newspaper. So he's well placed to tell us exactly what happened and where we are now. Can I ask you, when did the Freeman Tribunal start?
I remember it well. It was the 6th of February 2019. I remember getting that train at, I think it was 6:25 in the morning, up from Euston to Manchester, which became a regular journey over the next couple of years or so. And we turned up 9 o'clock. We were told there's going to be a small delay. We just sawing a few things out, and then that delay lasted several months, and it wasn't until the autumn that it actually kicked off.
I mean, what did it feel like? You're a sports reporter. You must have felt like a court reporter. Did it feel like a court case?
Absolutely, it did. The other thing I think is worth mentioning, it sort of went from naught to 100 miles an hour, back to naught again very quickly. There were sort of periods where, to be honest, it was very dry, very technical. At other times, it was quite clear that some of the questions that you thought should have been asked weren't being asked. And I think that was partly because I think Freeman's lawyer, Mary Watt, was clearly being instructed perhaps not to ask certain things of certain people. Freeman himself said how much he admired Dr. Steve Peters, for example. And I think what could have been made about the fact that when Phil Burt rushed into his office and sort of said, there's this package of testosterone has arrived, Peters, in the words of Rourke, along the lines of didn't really want to know much about it or where, you know, who was being ordered for, whatever else, which was odd, but that was never really pursued. And then you had, you know, Shane Sutton turning up and, you know, a one-man cyclone. And an extraordinary performance, one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen, probably, certainly in a sort of a courtroom or formal setting as well. So, yeah, it went from naught to 100 and back again. It mostly was very sort of low hum, but it did explode into life on occasion.
I mean, I guess it was a tribunal to assess Freeman's fitness to practice, and we're still going to hear the verdict on that. And I guess from our point of view, we were interested in the sporting implications, you know, what this Testagel in particular was for, who it was for and why. And was that, did that make your job more difficult because their focus was on almost on something else, whereas yours and our interest was in this one question, I suppose?
Yeah, although I'd say the two did merge. The key thing to point out here was that the balance of probabilities was the sort of the thing that Freeman was being judged on. So a lower standard of proof than in a court of law.
Mm.
So there wasn't evidence really of any specific rider. There were some parts of the case that went behind closed doors, but I'm led to believe that there wasn't any sort of dramatic revelations in there either. But essentially, the two things were saying they were looking at that whole period in British cycling and also assessing Freeman's fitness and you know whether he'd done the right thing as doctor as well.
I guess they weren't. It's relevant to the GMC which rider, if anybody, did use Testagel. You know, the fact that it was in their view for a rider is an important thing. I guess the UK anti-doping investigation will be more focused, perhaps, will it, on who the Testagel was for, or will it just be again Freeman in the dock?
Good question. I think it's unclear. The fact that the statute of limitations should run out in a couple of months makes you wonder how much UK anti-doping will be able to find who it was supposedly for. Also, they have had a go at this before, and that's why the case was referred to GMC, because UK anti-doping didn't really have the investigative powers and hadn't really got that far in ascertaining what was in the jiffy bag and whatever else. So I would be surprised if UK anti-doping rushed into life and in the next couple of months found out who it was for. But you know, hope springs eternal and all that.
What were your impressions of Richard Freeman throughout this process?
It's a good question. I think it's worth reflecting that he has had a lot of sort of periods where his mental health hasn't been very good, and I think anyone that has to be in the dock giving evidence for it was on and off. I think it was 7 weeks in total. You know, it can't have been easy. I would say he oscillated between periods where he was clearly, he knew the subject very well and you could believe what he was saying, whether it was sort of technical things. And yet there are other periods that you just looked and thought, why are you saying this? So when he sort of said that he didn't know the fine print of the wider code, you thought, well, you're saying this, but at the same time earlier you were making great play that you were one of the first people to be sort of one of the BMG's sort of sport doctors, you know, certificates. That's odd. He sort of didn't really, he claimed that he didn't realize how important testosterone was for recovery and other things. And again, you think, come on, you've worked for, you know, Bolton Wanderers, you've worked in professional cycling, does that really make sense? And I think perhaps ultimately it's why the medical tribunal thought that he was guilty ultimately, was that he had admitted telling a series of lies you know, at the start of the tribunal, including lying to UK anti-doping and keeping poor medical records, etc., etc. But I think when he said things like that, and it was referred to in the report that he didn't know about testosterone, then I thought people thought, well, how can we trust anything else that he's told us?
And I mean, final question or second last question, a piece, something you mentioned in your piece, is this question of why Dave Brailsford wasn't called. Do you have any idea why? Do you think he should have been called?
Well, Mary O'Rourke, who I mentioned earlier is Freeman's QC, you know, said at one point he was the spectre missing at his proceedings.
Hmm.
And quite rightly, she said, you know, he would have been able to answer an awful lot of questions about what was going on at British Cycling and Team Sky, yet he was never called. It's up to, obviously, both parties to decide who they want to call. And the GMC decided not to. And for whatever reason, Mary O'Rourke, the Freeman's sister, also decided not to. So therefore, he wasn't called. So it's, I imagine Freeman, the decision on would have come from Freeman not to call him. And the GMC perhaps would have thought anything he said wouldn't have advanced their case.
So what next, Sean? I mean, we're waiting for the GMC verdict. Well, we know their verdict, but what the penalty, what the decision will be with regards to Freeman's fitness to practice. But what next? And what next for Richard Freeman in particular?
Well, he's this forthcoming week, he will be, there are three more days of the tribunal where they will be asking whether his ability to practice medicine has been impaired by the verdict. And then there's another section in April where they will then decide which disciplinary matters or sanctions, rather, apologies, to implement. And that could be anything from being struck off to a suspension, but most likely, I think it would, given what we've heard, it would veer towards the steeper sanction. He will have until May the 5th to appeal any pronouncement that the MPTS has done. And he gave an interview yesterday in the Mail on Sunday where he remained insistent that the testosterone was for Shane Sutton, and repeated that he had never doped a rider.
Well, that was Sean Ingle of The Guardian telling us all about, you know, what happened at the tribunal, where Richard Freeman goes now, and what's next. I mean, it's fair to say that in one sense, we don't know any more than we knew a week ago. We know that testosterone was ordered to the velodrome by Richard Freeman. We still don't know who it was for, although the tribunal has decided it was for an athlete. But when this verdict came through, it went off like a bombshell in Britain, certainly. And it's left a huge, huge stain on British cycling, Team Sky. And until we know the identity of the athlete who they think it was for, or who it was for, then it casts a shadow over an awful lot of people. I mean, what are your thoughts, Lionel?
Well, first of all, I suppose the unfortunate thing is that the Medical Practitioners Tribunal is not charged with the task of finding out who it was delivered for. They are determining whether Dr. Richard Freeman is fit to practice as a doctor. And we will find out what the punishment for Dr. Freeman is in due course. But they found him guilty, and they are able to conclude that Freeman ordered the testo gel for an athlete. And, you know, from what has been demonstrated at the hearing that has made it into the public domain, it's a puzzle that they are able to make that claim as stridently as they have done. But they have done, and that now puts the spotlight, I think, on UK anti-doping to take this case up and try to get to the bottom of it. I suppose several things still puzzle me, not least testosterone gel turning up at British Cycling headquarters in May 2011, and then the whole sequence of different excuses. Freeman initially saying that it was returned, and asking Fit for Sport, the company that had sent the package, to basically write an email saying that it had been sent in error in the first place. And then it comes out that he'd taken it home and washed it down the sink. I mean, there's so many versions of what happened that we don't even have a sort of definitive version that we can say, well, that is the truth. And I suppose the second thing for me is that, it gives Team Sky's critics plenty of ammunition. I've seen, lots of people talking about, casting a sceptical eye over everything that Team Sky has done as a result of this. And unsurprisingly, because it does cast a shadow over everything they've done. One of the things that Team Sky had made an awful lot of, and Dave Brailsford had made an awful lot of, was this aggregation of marginal gains and looking at every small detail to improve performance, to improve recovery. It's very easy stick to now beat them with, to mock them for, having taken their own mattresses around hotels at Grand Tours or doing deep cleans of hotel rooms. But they did do all of those things. They did have an eye on all of those small details. And I think when we look at where we are now, the most extraordinary thing is that on a fundamental issue like this, there has not been the same level of curiosity, of scrutiny, of rigour by Dave Brailsford, by Dr. Steve Peters, in trying to find out exactly what happened. It's almost like they've pushed the issue into the arms of medical authorities and UK anti-doping and have no real curiosity to find out what actually happened. And that, to me, is extraordinary.
I think that's extraordinary as well, Lionel, and particularly because I think they're indebted particularly to two groups of people. They're indebted to the fans, the public, on whose support they've constructed the whole edifice of their reputation and their success. There would have been no Team Sky if there hadn't been an audience for it, and there would be no knighthood. There would be none of the adulation, none of the palmarès, none of the laurels. And they also owe the same rigour to the clean athletes that have been through that programme, because at the moment they're sort of being besmirched by association. I know there are some sceptics who will say, well, they were, you know, it's a systematic doping programme and, you know, there are no innocent parties in this. I don't believe there's any evidence to really back that up at this stage. So, Dave Brailsford's silence is not, it's probably inexcusable. Maybe he's collecting his thoughts. He's assembling a team of people, or, you know, as he often has in the past, to hopefully get to the truth. But really, you know, it's always baffled me that there wasn't a press conference called, you know, the day after this. I can't remember when this specific allegation came out or how it specifically came out, but that there wasn't a sort of press conference called the next day with Bradley Wiggins, Steve Peters, everyone involved. Again, demonstrating the same rigour and the same determination to be forensic. That they have allegedly, we think, and reportedly shown on other matters.
Well, on one particular matter, remember when Chris Froome at the Vuelta in 2017 exceeded the salbutamol level? You know, the length that Brailsford put together a team of people to basically demonstrate that the salbutamol absorption level threshold in the regulations was arbitrary, and to sort of the resources that went into making their case were significant, I think. And I don't, from the distance I'm looking at this, I don't see the same resources, the same rigour, the same intensity going into this matter, or for that matter, the whole issue about the what was in the package that went to the Dauphiné in 2011. Now, of course, Dave Brailsford said to the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee hearing that that was Flumacil, an over-the-counter decongestant. So perhaps in his mind, he's completely satisfied with that issue. But this issue is different, Richard. As you said, there is no grey area with testosterone. It's a doping product in sport. It's not allowed. You can't get a doctor's note to use it. So
This is really important. I can remember vividly when the story broke, and it was David Walsh in the Sunday Times who reported on this delivery of Testo gel. And it was on the final day of Paris-Nice in 2017. And I spoke to Dave Brailsford that morning about it. And he professed to be completely shocked to discover this. Steve Peters, head of medicine at the time, has said that he didn't tell Brailsford. The package arrived. It was opened by Phil Burt, the physiotherapist, who reacted with alarm to the contents, took it to Steve Peters. Steve Peters asked Richard Freeman what it was. Freeman said it had obviously been sent in error. We know now that that wasn't the case. And, you know, right from that moment, Freeman was telling lies, not telling the truth about what happened. And we still don't know with great confidence. I mean, the tribunal basically found, I think, Freeman's lies made it extremely difficult to believe anything that he'd said. And so it was very easy to dismiss his story about it being for Shane Sutton. But one thing I will say, I mean, I've said from the start, you know, testosterone, this is really serious, you know, and it remains really serious, you know.
Well, Rich,
if it was for an athlete, it really does matter.
Well, Rich, amid the kind of jumble of various different accusations that all emerged at a similar time, we did say, I remember saying on the podcast that this was the one that could ultimately sink the ship, because with some of the others, there was some ambiguity about whether any doping, even the crime that they were being accused of, was tantamount to doping. Whereas in this case, there was no doubt whatsoever. It's cut and dry.
Just one point on what you say there, Richard, about Dr. Steve Peters not telling Brailsford about this. I find that extraordinary as well. You know, Dave Brailsford is the head of not only Team Sky, but British Cycling at the time. Dave Brailsford's the CEO, effectively, of that whole organisation. You know, in political terms, he's the Prime Minister or the President. And not telling him that, not giving him that piece of information, doesn't protect him. It actually damages him. It makes it much, much harder for, you know, for the whole picture to be uncovered accurately and to everyone's satisfaction if the person running the whole show is kept in the dark. So if he was kept in the dark, that was a very big mistake, I think. And if he wasn't kept in the dark and he knew, then he should have been, you know, leading an investigation to find out exactly what's happened. But my sense is that he's tried to keep as much distance from this issue as possible over the years since it's come out. And
has it not helped, chaps, as well, the fact that the fact that there's an association, well, that really this story is half about Team Sky and half about British Cycling, that should mean that there's a different level of scrutiny and different level of accountability because it's taxpayer money. And you know, hopefully that will come with the UK anti-doping investigation. But does it not help that with Team Sky and Ineos, this team has been associated with two organisations for whom reputational damage has been part of the journey to, you know, where they've got to. And I'm talking about Jim Ratcliffe at Ineos and the Murdochs, really, with Sky. They're very accustomed to being accused of, well, all sorts. And consequently, there hasn't, from kind of corporate HQ, there hasn't been the same imperative and there hasn't been the same pressure on Dave Brailsford. And in a lot of organisations, you know, that press conference the next day would have had to be called. Otherwise, Dave Brailsford would have, you know, he would have been fired or asked to resign. But I don't get the sense that he's faced too much pressure.
We should mention that Bradley Wiggins on a rival podcast has said there should be an inquiry into this. Well, he should certainly care that we find out, you know, if it was for an athlete, who the athlete was. You mentioned Jim Ratcliffe there, Daniel. Very good podcast by Tortoise, the slow media organisation, on Ineos and Jim Ratcliffe. Recommend that if you want to know more about the company and the culture there.
Would you agree with that, though, chaps?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you listen to that podcast, the whole story of Jim Ratcliffe's journey in business is, you know, it puts in context his investment in sport and cycling, what he might want out of it, for sure. It's a fascinating bit of context. Can I just say one thing, just returning to the story? I mean, what I've said throughout, right from the start, is I do think, you know, for all the, you mentioned the, you know, whether this is, I've seen parallels with US Postal and, you know, this being the tip of the iceberg as far as, you know, a kind of organized doping program at Team Sky. I've always said and thought that at the heart of this is the story of a few individuals. And I think, you know, I think Shane Sutton is at the centre of it. And, you know, Sean Ingle there said that he had some sympathy for Richard Freeman. And I think it's hard not to, not least because he's now certainly the scapegoat for what's gone on. But he's also had mental health problems. But he's also, you know, definitely been scared of Shane Sutton and felt that Shane Sutton behaved towards him in a way that would be described by other people as bullying. That's the testimony that I've got from people who worked at British Cycling. So I think that, you know, regardless of the verdict of the medical tribunal, at the heart of this is the relationship between, in particular, Shane Sutton and Richard Freeman. And another Sean Ingle story in The Guardian recently was a concerning an anonymous email sent to UK Sport complaining about Shane Sutton. And that all came about around the time of Jess Varnish's departure. Richard Freeman was very close to Jess Varnish when she left. And that began the unravelling of Shane Sutton's career at British Cycling. And it's all tied in together.
I mean, this incident happened nearly 10 years ago now, and Dr. Freeman remained doctor at British Cycling and Team Sky for several years afterwards. And I suppose that's what the point I made at the start about the lack of curiosity, the lack of rigour. If Freeman had been found to be up to no good in 2011, he would have been sacked at some point. You know, if there'd been a rigorous internal investigation into what he'd been doing and he'd been found to have done wrong, he wouldn't have kept his job. So, I mean, there's so many questions to ask about the way it was handled internally. over not just, you know, 6 months, but over years. And from listening to Bradley Wiggins on his podcast, you know, all of the riders, it's in their interest to find out what happened, because like it or not, and without sort of pointing fingers in any particular directions, if the narrative of the story from an organisation that has a sort of almost a sort of parliamentary privilege to make a claim that the testo gel was ordered with Dr. Freeman's knowledge that it was for a rider, that casts a shadow over the whole of Manchester Velodrome and the whole of Team Sky's operation at the time. And so it should be in the interests of the people that were involved at the time, and especially in the interests of people who are still involved in the, whether it be on the British Cycling side or now the Team Ineos side, to get to the bottom of it, find out what happened, and put it to bed. And there must be reasons why that isn't happening. Just on the point of some of the reporting, though, because of the timeline, we've seen some pretty wild reporting. Daniel, you were talking about an Italian story which seemed to allege that the testo gel was what was in the package that went to the Dauphiné in June.
Well, no, it was actually written that it was delivered during the Tour de France.
Right. I mean, again, it is a confusing web of, you know, so many different events, so many different characters, so many different allegations that even in the public domain, there's stuff being written that is incorrect. And if I can just make, I don't want to single out particular stories, but the Mail on Sunday had a story in which it kind of reheated something that had been written before about Shane Sutton raising questions and doubts about Chris Froome's performances in 2012. And again, when it comes to sort of sorting and sifting through the detail of what has happened and the cast of characters involved, you know, even in that story, it says that Sutton made this, made these fears known about what he thought about Froome to Steve Peters and Dave Brailsford at a time when he himself was finding his conduct being scrutinised. And I find it staggering that sort of, you know, motive and opportunity are not being sifted through as well when it comes to weighing up the credibility of all of the different parties and what they actually say about what they did and what they knew and when they knew it.
Just finally from me, chaps, we've sort of said that, you know, there's a murder weapon has been found, but no murderer at the moment, in the sense that the, you know, this, we know this testosterone gel was ordered, but we're now... the search begins presumably for the athlete who
the body's yeah. Also missing.
Well, the body's, yeah, well, exactly. Just something that Bradley Wiggins said in his podcast about, well, you know, if a rider was taking the testosterone, then it would have been, they would have been caught. That's not necessarily true. I've been exchanging emails this morning with the former director of the French anti-doping agency, Michel Audran, just about testosterone detection. And it's been a problem through the ages, really, of anti-doping detecting this substance. Particularly testo gel was first approved in Europe in 2003. We know it's been widely abused. It's been linked to other high-profile doping cases like the Floyd Landis one. If you go back to 2011, the method that was being used then to detect it, the detection window was pretty small. It was maximum 48 hours, depending on how much was taken. So, you know, there is a real possibility that back then it could have been used, and, you know, it helps recovery. It's a widely used doping product. And I think testosterone positives still account for more and more doping positives than any other substance, but it's a widely used product, and it could definitely have been used back then, which is not to say, you know, certainly not to say that, you know, that the testosterone that was ordered by Richard Freeman definitely went to a Team Sky or British Cycling rider.
I mean, your comment there, Lionel, about the sort of the lack of curiosity and rigor in, you know, investigating or finding out a bit more about people, that goes right back to the start of Team Sky and when the team was set up. And I know it caused a bit of friction in your relationship with Dave Brailsford at the time. And you sort of laid all that out in a series of very very compelling blogs where you spoke about reporting on Team Sky. Now, you're turning these into Friends specials, aren't you?
Well, at your suggestion, Rich, I just, over the weekend, as the Richard Freeman story has shaken out, and all of the details of what's gone on over the years has sort of come back to the fore. You may remember that I wrote a three-part series of articles. I published them on my website in about 3 years ago. It's March 2018 now. And I didn't get round to finishing part four or maybe part five.
Which got very favourable reviews from, among others, Mark Cavendish.
Is that right? Wow, yes. There we are.
Really?
Gosh. Wow. Anyway, I've now written a fourth part, and I wasn't sure what to do with it. And Richard, you suggested, why not record them and put them on the Friends of the Podcast feed? So that's what I'm in the process of doing this week. So they will go up episodically, part one, two, three, and four, over the course of the rest of this week.
Inspired also by your recent Friends special on Pyrenees and Sean Kelly. You know, in Friends specials, we try to do different things, don't we? And it's a sort of different form of storytelling, I suppose. But I should apologize.
I mean, a lot of me droning on at the moment then for people. People who don't enjoy me droning on.
It's an acquired taste. I mean, you know, you don't have to listen to them, but they're very good. They're very good. You might have a little cameo from one or two other people, no?
Possibly. We need someone to play Dave Brailsford.
I'm going to play Dave Brailsford as a, I don't know, I'll think of a character. But, you know, that'll be coming up on the Friends of the Podcast feed. There's lots more there as well, including your recent Sean Kelly Pyrenees story, which is an excellent listen. And coming up very soon, and this leads nicely into Slow Radio, we'll have also the audio diaries of the four young riders who are keeping diaries for us at a very challenging time for them when they really don't have very many races at all. But we've got Joe Laverick, Red Walters, Hannah Ludwig and Marjolein van 't Geloof keeping audio diaries for us. And they're being put together at the moment. Some great stuff in there. And as I say, it's a really difficult time for some of those riders who are not getting as many races as they normally would. But Red Walters is a guy who's going to join a French team this year. He previously rode for Vitus in the UK, a continental level. He's hoping to join a French team in Britain. He can't get there yet. And he's been doing a lot of racing on Zwift. And so he sent me in a bit of audio from him setting up for a session on the turbo.
Time.
Well, that was Slow Radio for this episode. We'll have another one later in the week. And that was Red Walters, who'll be featuring in our audio diaries. It's going to be a good listen, that I promise, if you're interested in what these young guys are up to, young guys and girls. And we're getting loads of submissions for Slow Radio now, so thank you very much. We've got some really good ones to come up. If you've got something to send us, contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. Just before we go in this episode, I should mention as well our partnership with LACA, the bike insurance people. If you're looking for insurance for your bikes or equipment, sign up and join the cycling podcast community within LACA. Go to laka.co, that's laka.co. Enter the code podcast when you sign up. That'll automatically put you in the cycling podcast community. It will also mean that you'll get 30 days of free cover. And if you sign up in March, you might win a Rafa LACA jersey. There'll be one jersey to give away to somebody who signs up in March and uses the code podcast. That's at laka.co. Anything else for this episode, chaps, before we return later in the week with Tirreno Adriatico and Milan Sanremo?
It's been a bumper one, hasn't it? I mean, lots to talk about from Paris-Nice, and obviously the Richard Freeman story breaking before the weekend as well. Tirreno Adriatico, I mean, very quiet race, not really much going on. Can't imagine we'll have
not
too
much
to
going
talk
on
about.
There, you know. Yeah, I've been snoozing through most of it, to be honest. But we'll find something to say about it, I'm sure. But we'll be back. That should be out Wednesday, we think. Wednesday evening, perhaps. So we'll be back to discuss that and look ahead to Milan Sanremo, the first monument of the season. Or the third monument, if you count Strada Bianca and, as Mikhail Kwiatkowski suggested, stage 5 of Tirreno Adriatico. Anyway, that's all for this episode. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.